Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the final interim meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And members, we do have a quorum. We have several really interesting informational reports to receive, but we do have a bit of business to do first. So I will open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. And Vice Chair Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move that the following committee bills be introduced as committee bills, and they are LC-229, LC-230, LC-442, LC-1409, LC-2643, LC-2644, LC-2730, LC-2895, and lastly, LC-2925, to be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you for that motion, Senator Telfer. And as usual, introduction of these measures does not imply support of or opposition to or any opinion whatsoever about these measures. It simply allows them to move forward for bill introduction. So, any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we don't have, that's it. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? And the bills are introduced. And I will close the work session. The first thing on our agenda is a report that we have long been waiting for on from the Green Jobs Council, and this is something that this committee has talked about, has been very interested in looking at projections for jobs that where we expect some growth and expansion and where there's real workforce readiness to be done, too. And so we are really excited to hear from a panel. I see one of our colleagues, Representative David Edwards, if you would like to come forward to introduce this panel, and then we'll ask the panel to come forward because I don't think we have quite enough chairs for everybody. Sure. Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Telfer, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce the final draft of the Oregon Green Jobs Growth Plan. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I represent Greater Hillsborough in the Oregon House. Quickly, to develop this plan, the governor convened the Oregon Green Jobs Council, which consists of representatives from state government, business, and labor. In addition, the Oregon Community College and Workforce Development Department hired a consulting firm, 3E Strategies, to work closely with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and Business Oregon to staff the Green Jobs Council, conduct any required research, and write the plan. As you know, Oregon is a leader in sustainable development and clean technology. We have the country's highest per capita employment in green jobs. And the pace of green job growth is more than three times that of job growth generally. The Green Jobs Growth Plan is designed to capitalize on these trends. In these uncertain economic times, training today's workforce requires innovative ideas and bold initiatives. A coordinated and well-planned clean tech workforce policy approach will help ensure job growth in today's most promising sectors and give Oregon a competitive edge in the global economy. The plan has its origins in House Bill 3300, which passed during the last regular session. The bill specified a number of tasks, notably developing a plan that leverages and aligns existing public programs to train and support green-collar workers, formulating and recommending new or expanded financial incentives, and other strategies designed to recruit, retain, or expand green economy businesses, and lastly, identifying emerging technologies and innovations that are likely to contribute to advancements in the green economy. So I'm pleased to report that due to the enthusiasm and diligent efforts of the Council and its staff, the final plan exceeds the scope of the authorizing legislation, mainly by presenting a coordinated short and long-term plan aligned with traded sector strategies, and by providing substantial context for our recommendations. Shortly, Sylvia Hayes of 3E Strategies will walk you through the plan, which in part leverages the Oregon Employment Department survey of the state's green economy. You may recall that at the time the survey was conducted, we were only the second state in the country after Washington State to conduct such a survey. And shortly after, the Oregon Employment Department was awarded a federal grant to build on that initial survey. So we have a unique opportunity to further our understanding of the employment prospects in this particular area. As a two-term member of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, I understand the magnitude of the budget crisis you face in the next regular session. And during those upcoming budget deliberations, I urge you to remember that the best remedy for our economic plight is a robust economy, and to dedicate resources to jumpstart it. This plan is aimed squarely at growing Oregon businesses and improving the lives of many low- and middle-income workers who are suffering the worst consequences of the current economic climate. So now that I've had the privilege of delivering the preliminaries, with the chair's permission, I will turn the dais over to Dave Williams, co-chair of the Oregon Green Jobs Council, and beg your forgiveness in returning to my committee in down the hall.
Thank you very much, Representative Edwards, and thank you for your leadership in bringing this project forward.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I have to say that the council consisted of just outstanding individuals, and I'm really pleased with the final plan that you'll receive a summary of shortly.
So, yeah, if the whole panel would like to come forward, and we have with us David Williams, who's the chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. The chair is very pleased to be a member of that, and I'm really looking forward to your introduction and then to our other witnesses. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and Senate Committee. Yes, my name is Dave Williams. One hat is Vice President of Utility Services at Northwest Natural. My other hat, important to today's subject, is chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. So as Senator Edwards did a great job of really setting the stage for this report, I'm going to add just a little bit more and tell you a little bit about our process as we went through that. Again, House Bill 3300 put in motion Oregon's Workforce Investment Board's role in the development of the Oregon Green Jobs Plan. And I, along with my co-chair, Lori Luchak, who is the president of Miles Fiberglass, joined together and worked on the governor's appointed Green Jobs Council, which is the group that actually did the work. This Green Jobs Council will continue on in making sure it assures the implementation of the plan as well. The team consisted, as Senator Edwards said, private business, labor, workforce and education, energy efficiency experts, local workforce investment boards, Department of Energy, legislators, and Oregon Business Development Department. The plan was really put together with three critical, important core strategies. One was making sure that we got stakeholder input and feedback on the plan's development. The other was using a targeted industry sectors organization into 8 green sector strategies, and using research and data analysis to drive our decision-making. Although this was a business-led group, there was tremendous amount of effort put in to support it by all of the stakeholders, and we went through painstaking efforts to make sure that we got appropriate input from many people and many sources, as was evidenced by the many drafts that we put together. Special recognition to Greg White, staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, who sits behind me, and as well as our consultant and Sylvia Hayes, owner of 3E Strategies, with whom we contracted to help us through this process in developing the plan. And I think with that, we'd like to have Sylvia just take you through the plan itself.
Thank you, David. Sylvia, you good to see you.
Good to see you.
You want to introduce yourself and...
Sylvia Hayes, founder and CEO of 3E Strategies, also from Bend, Oregon. I'll be quick with this. Probably many of you know this, but the Oregon Employment Department was one of the first employment departments in the nation to wrestle with the not simple job of defining what a green job is, and we have used that definition throughout the Green Jobs Plan as it was set forth in HB 3300. That's the official Oregon definition. any job that increases energy efficiency, produces renewable energy, prevents or mitigates environmental degradation, cleans up the natural environment, and pretty much any education, consulting, support position that would support and contribute to the first four. Just to give a little bit more of a background on the opportunities before us here, as Representative Edwards mentioned, Oregon is well known now for our leadership in this emerging clean economy. And just a few points here, these are mostly focused on energy, which is one piece of the clean economy, but the one that's probably easiest to quantify. Already just the four top renewable energy sectors, wind, solar, hydrogen, and biofuel, have exceeded the overall revenue impact of the international music industry with constant and consistent projections for significant ongoing growth. I think it's really interesting, and you'll see it when we get to the sector strategy, especially when we're dealing with the clean energy part of the green jobs world. It's really important to think of clean energy as both energy efficiency as well as renewables, because the efficiency is actually where our biggest job growth opportunities look to be right now. LOHAS, it's a very interesting consumer trend. It's lifestyles of health and sustainability. It's now estimated to be about 20% of the U.S. population. It's any of us who like to buy organic food or undyed cotton, whatever it may be, products that have to do with environmental sustainability, fitness, and health and well-being. Currently in Oregon was identified by the Pew Charitable Trust in 2009 as one of three states that have both a relatively large and fast-growing clean energy sector. Colorado and Tennessee were the other two. That quote is directly out of their report. Not only are we one of the top three, but green jobs are growing, even in the early part of the recession, much more quickly, almost five times the rate of conventional non-green jobs. Another interesting part of all of this is that there's great diversity across the economy as to where those jobs are found. So it's important to think of this not as replacing conventional industries or only supporting the new, shiny, emerging green industries, but it's really a greening across the economy, an adding of sustainability and clean tech competencies, even to Oregon's legacy industries. And to put a face to it, I think I missed one, to put a face to some of our green jobs, this is a photo here on the bottom of Miles Fiberglass, of which our co-chair is intimately aware and represents, and this is just one of their crews standing in front of one of the wind turbines that they now provide products to. Again, a conventional company that's now entered the clean tech, clean energy world in a significant way. This on the corner bottom right here is an interesting Oregon company. It's Agroplas. They are a company that recycles mostly non-recyclable agricultural plastics. They actually extract the crude from that and then recycle the plastic as well. Very interesting and innovative approach. Wages. As I'll get to in a couple of slides, HB 3300 required us to look at wage levels, not just getting people employed, but getting them employed in well-paying jobs and jobs that eventually lead to a family wage. This is an area that needs a lot more work, as our employment department folks that are here could tell you, but what we know at this point is that the green jobs in Oregon tend to have slightly higher wages than non-green jobs. You'll see about $22.61 an hour compared to $19.92. And two-thirds of Oregon's existing green jobs that we've quantified so far actually meet our state's definition of a high wage. 23% high-wage green jobs require a bachelor's degree or higher, but what's interesting overall is that I believe it's two-thirds of all of our green jobs really require no education beyond high school. Some will require a specialty certificate, but there's great variation. But those high-paying green jobs definitely do. As our chairperson mentioned, we have adopted fundamentally to the Oregon Green Jobs Plan as a sectoral approach. This is building upon the work that's already been done in Oregon around the healthcare sector. Business Development Department, Employment Department have spent a lot of work on clusters or sectors. And we really went through some exhaustive criteria to come out with what would be the sectors within the green jobs realm that we would prioritize. This is their list in order of priority: energy efficiency, renewable energy, green manufacturing, energy transmission, distribution, and storage. Those first four we're recommending action on in phase one, and I will get to that in a second. The second four: green building and development, transportation, ag and sustainable forestry, and environmental technologies and services are second priority, and we are recommending action on those in phase two, which I'll also explain. And I will say that in the full text of the plan, there's detailed description of what those sectors are and the rationale and criteria behind how we came up with this prioritized approach. Sector strategies were landed upon, again, because Oregon already has some core competency in this area. We can leverage some resources, but also because we're beginning to see now that there are higher wages paid to these sector strategy initiatives when folks have gone through those programs. And again, this is an Oregon Green Jobs success story. This is a new generation streetcar produced by Oregon Ironworks. In the plan, we identified five choke points to job creation in Oregon, and we addressed our strategies to them. They're listed here. I don't have time today to link all of our strategies to these, but lack of access to capital, particularly lack of economic development incentives for existing businesses, inadequate skill levels across the entire workforce, need for significant amounts of remediation, for instance, even to get someone's math skills up to a level where they could go through an energy audit and energy weatherization technician program, a number of regulatory barriers, difficulty getting projects moving forward, and then really inadequate coordination among relevant state agencies and institutions related to workforce and economic development, and a number of systemic reasons for that. We have three phases. You'll see in the plan there are assumptions for each of these phases. The primary assumption in phase one is that it's a very difficult fiscal situation that we're dealing with. Resources are limited. Additional assumption is that there may be some follow-on or some additional federal stimulus funds that could go to these sorts of approaches. We have nine strategies that are listed here, and to give you a sense of why this plan is this thick, there are 54 specific recommended actions in the plan that are listed under these nine strategies. Clearly can't cover all of that today, but we'll give you a heads up. We recommend that we restructure the Green Jobs Council to function more as an intensive action team for job creation. We recommend investing resources in developing sector strategies for those top four priority sectors, establishing economic development and access to capital tools, and expanding existing. As capacity allows, implementing policies to support those four second priority sectors. And it's important to note that it's not all or nothing. There are already economic development incentives, initiatives underway really in all eight of those sectors. So we're not saying throw it all out, but we had to help prioritize somewhere. Providing marketing assistance to industries, we heard that from industry a lot. They want the state to be much more supportive in helping them tell their story. Enhance and coordinate green job training and career pathway opportunities. One of the ways that we dealt with if you're going to be putting public resources or public-private resources into training programs, how do you ensure that the jobs coming out of those programs pay a decent wage? Because not every clean energy company can pay a family wage in every position. The high schooler who is helping you lug your tools across to install a solar panel, for instance. So there's a lot of emphasis in this plan on establishing career pathway opportunities and building career maps, which there's already significant progress underway across the spectrum in Oregon. Lots of lots of emphasis in this plan on being adaptable. This is an emerging field, and obviously the economy is emerging and evolving right now. We've built recommendations and mechanisms into this to be able to do a quick measurement of outcomes and then make adaptations going forward, up to and including in that second phase, perhaps veering from those four second-tier industry sectors based on the constant improvement in our labor market information. Also, we call for better interagency coordination, leadership. We give some specific recommendations around that. And then since in phase one, you all will be dealing with a legislative session, we've identified a whole series of key legislative concepts and pieces that might be moving through this session that would impact green jobs development. I apologize for these text-dense slides, but there's a lot of information to get in here. Phase two, which is 2014 through 2016, we have 10 specific strategies, and under those, 24 specific actions that are listed out in the plan. There's not a lot new in this. It's a continuation of some, except that we're now saying, hopefully, we've made significant progress on developing sector strategies for those first four, and we'll get started on the second four in phase two. Also, the convening of a Green Job, Green Economy Summit to share results, best practices, and again, make some course corrections going forward. And then phase three really is primarily just about evaluating where this is going, since by this time we're all the way out to 2017, which is a long time given the rate of change in the clean economy world right now. This is mostly just about really doing evaluation, seeing what's working, and seeing what our next steps would be going forward. This is, I think, my last substantive slide, and again, it's busy, but the family wage requirement in HB 3300 was something that everyone was very supportive of, but probably no news to you, was pretty tricky. And that's defined differently. We did not have unanimous consent in our group about how we ought to handle that, and we had an entire subcommittee that worked on this throughout the process. And what we did, rather than giving you an actual hard definition of what a family wage should be, is we've given some criteria for how we think training programs that develop economic development incentives that we're utilizing, how they could basically have a filter that we think would best enable us to have the outcome result in family wage jobs. And that really includes an emphasis on self-sufficiency, again, and increasing an already existing state prosperity and economic independence index. Should cover basic expenses, and this committee decided that that should include health care, food, housing, all the way through education expenses. This third bullet point really was a point of contention, I think, for us, not contention, that's a better word. Some of the non-cost of living-based measures that have been used to define family wages going forward really don't indicate adequately, according to our group, what it actually takes to raise a family. And if family wage job is the outcome here, those need to be weighed with, if not skepticism, at least some thoroughness. Is that really going to get us to the outcome that we want? Definitely need to pay attention to geographic variations in the state because, for instance, a living wage in Multnomah County might be very different than a living wage in Deschutes County or in Crook County. And then industry and occupational variations need to be taken into account also. And this comes, again, with we need to allow the flexibility for entrepreneurialism to be very robust and vibrant on the front end with career pathways and opportunities to actually lead to family wage jobs as folks move through them. And then the last little piece in green there, this is actually straight out of the plan as well, that should the legislature decide to allow exceptions to the family wage requirement, in order to allow for those entry-level green jobs, they should be tied to, again, a well-thought-out identification of specific career pathways and training opportunities for those entry-level workers to eventually move up and be able to draw a higher wage. And with that, I will leave you with one of my favorite quotes lately. We're all faced with a series of great opportunities brilliantly disguised as insoluble problems. That's what you all will be facing with the fiscal issues on your plate.
Yeah, right.
Thank you. So at this point, I think, and I apologize that I was out of the room for a moment, but that's the end of your formal presentation.
Yes.
So then I'll open it up for questions. And I had one. I just was noticing that the total jobs figures in the report seem to be from 2008, and unfortunately, as we all know, we've lost a lot of those jobs. The total number is way lower now in terms of jobs that we have in the state. So were there proportionate reductions in the number of what we're calling green jobs in this report if we were to update this to 2010?
You know, I could anecdotally pull some things out there. A lot of that information was based on the Oregon Employment Department's really very cutting-edge report called The Greening of Oregon's Economy, which is one of the first programs later back there. I might call them up. We actually recommend, one of the recommendations in our report is that study is updated, because I don't know that we know. And we do throughout this report also, we're very honest about the fact that even though we've laid out metrics for evaluating the impacts of this, many of the baseline data needed to establish the metrics aren't there yet. So it's a challenging horse and cart problem with some of these industry sectors. Those eight industry sectors don't align really well with labor market information to even be able to get that information in a quick period of time. And Graham may have an update to that and put you on the spot. Do you have anything more to say?
Not really. There's no way to actually take that 50,000 and say, is it now 46,000? So.
Right, right. And then, so go ahead, Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way to determine of these jobs created, how many, or what the impact of the subsidy, whether it was the Betsy or whatever, what the impact of that help, assistance in subsidies was?
It's a good question. Definitely one of the criteria that we used, and as I said, you'll see that the criteria were extensive, was what the existing incentive climate looked like for these industries, both at a state and federal level. The only quantifiable, and I can't pull them out at the top of my head, but the report exists, evaluation of that I know of was done by Eco Northwest related to the business energy tax credit. There have been a series of those, and it definitely shows, despite some of the mismanagement shenanigan issues that were definitely apparent and were a problem, there's a clear return on investment for that money. But I can't pull it off the top of my head what the job creation impact is. But we can get to an estimate of that.
Follow up, thank you. Because the reason I ask that is, as we look at job creation in general in this state right now, but where are the dollars that the state might invest? Where are we getting the best bang for our buck, number one? And number two, how much of this growth in industry is because there was money available to subsidize the ventures getting going and things like that?
Significant. And the prioritization that we have done for the sector strategies really was based upon realistically, where do we think we could spur job growth facing the reality of the economy that we're in? So energy efficiency, right at the top of the list. There are creative financing opportunities to keep that going post our stimulus money that are not necessarily reliant upon just tax credits. So this team did a lot of work thinking through what some of those opportunities might be. It might surprise folks, for instance, that green building, which Oregon is an internationally renowned leader, did not make our top four tier. Or top four priority tier, and that's because even though we have a lot of competence there is a lot of existing both training opportunities and also skill and talent, we don't see a clear path to spurring the job growth in that one quite as quickly as we do in the top four. So the transmission and distribution one, which is fourth in our top four, that's almost just that's going to see significant job uptake just because that industry is facing a huge upcoming wave of retirement. So there's just a real natural turnover, surprisingly large, in that one that gives us an opportunity now to kind of skill up some of those green skills that will give them, for instance, competency not to just do conventional transmission lines, but also to start integrating smart grid and distributed generation and some of those issues. So we did think it through. It's all in there. Greg, did you have a specific?
Greg White, staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, members of the committee, Chair Rosenbaum. I do know that the Oregon Business Development Department, when they do an incentive to a company, whether it's a Betsy or another, have a series of criteria that must be adhered to by the company that receives the incentive. One of those is how many jobs created. So I'm sure that the information is available in answer to your question, Senator Telfer.
Through the other department. Okay, thank you.
Senator Monroe, did you have any questions?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
Very useful.
Well, so thank you for presenting this, and I'm sure we will take the time to read the full report. I think I know Senator Telfer and I were both at the Oregon Business Summit yesterday, and obviously some pretty ambitious goals were set out there, and I think a number of people in the audience were there, and you probably as well. I'm talking about adding 25,000 jobs a year over the next 10 years. Clearly, there's some real meaty stuff here in this report to lead us to some kind of blueprint. And, you know, it seems to me that some of the things like a summit that is laid out as something to do, I think in a couple of years, there's going to be a job summit coming up just later this year, and I would expect that probably a piece of that would be including some recommendations from this report, too. So I think there are lots of ways that we can start to get to work on this right away.
And to dovetail with that, actually, one of the recommendations in here is that we link this work in as integrated manner as possible with the Oregon Business Plan and the summit that happened yesterday. So they've had an emphasis on green sectors for quite a while, and I think that there's a way, to leverage activities that are already underway to keep this moving with a minimal commitment.
Right. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for all the work that went into this and for presenting it so succinctly today.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so next on our list we have another interesting topic, and this is the Highway Construction Workforce Diversity Report. We have Joan Plank from ODOT here. With her, I think she'll be introducing Michael Cobb from the Office of Civil Rights, and with them as well, Steve Sims from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm sure they will be talking about the genesis of this work, but members, you might remember that there was a bill which we actually passed out of this committee and then went through the Ways and Means process in 2009 that took a look and actually invested some resources in trying to do things a little differently in the way we allocate work and prepare for all that construction and highway work of the future to make sure that diverse communities and everybody in Oregon benefits from it. So that's broadly the topic here, and I'll turn it over to Joan Plank.
Great, thank you. I'm Joan Plank with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, the chair did a great introduction, so I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Cobb, our civil rights manager, to walk through the material.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Excuse me. My name is Michael Cobb. I'm the manager of the Office of Civil Rights, Workforce Development, Small Business Development with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'd just like to start with a brief background of the law by saying that this 2009 legislation requires that ODOT spend one half of 1% up to $1.5 million on programs that increase diversity in the highway construction workforce. The legislation describes certain activities to achieve these goals that closely match the activities that are identified in, under federal requirements for supportive services programs. Just as a matter of additional information, it would be interesting to note that ODOT had developed a workforce development program prior to the 2009 legislation with a focus on building a diverse workforce and skilled workforce to meet the current and future construction needs. The program prepares and supports participants for pre-apprenticeship opportunities for highway construction trades. Pre-apprenticeship are those activities that prepare a participant to be involved with an apprenticeship program later on. ODOT contracts with various supportive service providers, community colleges, community-based organizations, or CBOs as they're called, and also tribal governments across the state to provide these services. And moving forward to develop the program that we have right now under this legislation, we entered into a partnership with BOLI because they maintain a very close working relationship with contractors, supportive service providers, and the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. We entered into this agreement with BOLI back on January 15th of 2010. The supportive service model that we are developing covers both basic needs, such as transportation, child care, medical expenses, work attire, and tools, and training-related services, such as training, tuition, testing, fees, and safety gear, with a goal of covering each of the supportive services described in the 2009 law. Program activities will be offered in all of ODOT's five regions across the state, and we are looking also at the high schools for providing an awareness and opportunities for careers in highway construction. These activities will be provided by community-based organizations and BOLI supported and approved high school apprenticeship preparation programs. Some of the highlights of current activities, and you do have in your report a more detailed accounting of the activities on page 4, but some of the highlights of the current activities include an IGA between BOLI and Portland Community College and the Evening Trades Apprenticeship Preparation Program. Portland Community College, or PCC, provides outreach, recruitment, intake, and assessment services to new participants. PCC anticipates serving approximately 60 individuals in the Portland area, which started back in September of this year and will continue through June 30th of 2011. Additional activities include meeting with organizations such as the Urban League of Portland, the African American Chamber of Commerce, Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, Oregon Tradeswomen, Inc., and Rogue Community College, just to name a few. These meetings were held to increase our opportunities for building a very an effective and efficient program. Another important piece of the program is outreach and recruitment. We held a job fair. We have job fairs with announcements and invitations advertised in the media and had very positive results with individuals participating and some requesting apprenticeship, sponsorship, and mentoring. In the areas of basic skills improvement classes, meetings were held with Portland Community Cascade Campus and OTI, that's Oregon Tradeswomen, regarding development of heavy highway construction summer camps aimed at middle school and high school age girls and young women up to age 22. BOLI entered into an IGA with PCC to deliver 4 spring and summer camps, which started back in July of 2010 and will continue through June of 2011. In addition to the importance of outreach and recruitment, it is equally important to retain participants. The ETAP program provided mentoring and retention services to 23 participants, which started back in September of this year. Pre-employment counseling, career counseling, remedial training, entry requirements for training programs, supportive services, and assistance with transportation, child care, and other special needs will begin in January 2011 as a part of the planned program. In order to present a thorough statewide supportive services program at the start of 2011, BOLI finalized its RFP totaling approximately $1 million on December 6th of this year. BOLI will also continue to review potential direct contact, contract, or intergovernmental agreement opportunities that are aligned with the overall goals of this program. ODOT and BOLI will continue to discuss a number of other possible supportive services opportunities with provincial potential providers, such as Northwest Construction College, Park Road School District, who offers introductory courses in heavy highway carpentry, Construction Hope Pre-Apprentice Program, which targets former inmates, prison inmates, and Work Systems, Inc., to name a few. BOLI needs to align future projects with the current American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, the funding that we have received, to provide statewide monitoring contract and interagency agreement with Chemeketa Community College for high school training activities. Kind of in summary, ODOT continues to make steady progress in this area in implementing the requirements of this law. Intergovernmental agreements, partnerships with other agencies and organizations, and participation levels from a variety of groups and individuals are all evidence of efforts to move this initiative forward. It is not only a good investment for the state and its people, but at this point in time in this current economic situation, it is also a much-needed solution, and it's a long-term strategy for keeping our economy strong and sustainable, hopefully. And that is the end of the presentation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think Mr. Sims is prepared to make a few remarks as well about some of the work that they've been doing to get the RFP in place and some of the activities they've already undertaken. He's going to give you a little more information in terms of in addition to what Michael said, and then also if the committee is interested, Mr. Sims invited a couple of the groups that have received funding, and they can come up and give you a quick kind of overview of what they've done so far, if that's.
That would be great. Okay, great. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members, Madam Chair. Stephen Sims, S-I-M-M-S. I am the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. You have a copy of my testimony before you, and I won't read that. I just want to give you an update of the process we have followed so far, and also let you hear from some of the programs that we've funded through this process, and also hear from a couple of the people who've benefited from those efforts. The Bureau, as a part of its apprenticeship function, has always had an obligation to assist our apprenticeship programs in recruiting and retaining women and people of color. We've done a lot of different activities in that regard, many times working with community-based organizations to do the recruitment, to do the pre-training. One thing that both our program sponsors and those community-based groups have always told us is, gee, it'd be nice if we knew that we could run this program and not have to worry about funding. And it's a constant struggle. Industry helps some, agencies help some, but for those public nonprofits, it is sometimes difficult to maintain their activities. The Bureau also maintains a high school integration initiative program where we are attempting to integrate high school curriculum with real-life learning activities in the trades, the building and construction trades, the manufacturing trades. The ODOT Supportive Services Agreement fits squarely within the mission that we've tried to accomplish with respect to diversity, outreach, and recruitment. I'm very happy to say not only with respect to this initiative, but also with respect to other issues involving apprenticeship and transportation projects, such as prevailing wage issues, apprenticeship utilization, ODOT has been an exemplary partner, and we're happy to work with them. As we began to work on this this program, our initial process was to go out into the five ODOT regions in this state and talk with contractors, talk with industry associations, labor unions, and community-based groups and say, what do we need to do to get you to yes? What do we need to do to get more women and people of color employed on highway projects? And we heard a lot of interesting answers, but we didn't find a single solution. So after making that individual approach for a few months, we decided that the best thing to do was to put out a statewide RFP asking for the type of services that we heard contractors and community groups asking for and saying, can you provide us with these services? And as a condition of that RFP saying, you must tell us what your demonstrated ties with the construction industry in general, and the heavy highway industry in particular. What is your particular relationship to make sure that the services and activities performed are going to get people through the door? We are still in the RFP process right now, and we have received intent to bid from a number of different sources, including industry groups, labor organizations, employer organizations, apprenticeship communities, committees, and from community-based organizations. So we feel we can get the two parties together, the two sides together, to actually move someone from training into employment in the highway trades. That process, hopefully, we will have all the contracts issued by the middle of January. Some initial training will take place at the late part of the winter and early spring, and hopefully when the heavy highway employment picture begins to pick up in the spring, as it traditionally does, we will have a crop of new people to put in and to put out in the job. Resolving this issue of the disparity or the historical underrepresentation of women in the trades there's no one single solution. We need to have a broad approach. We know, for example, that one of the reasons why that women are not necessarily properly represented in the trades is at an early age. They're not encouraged. They don't necessarily get the skills and education and training to move them in that direction. So we need to have outreach to younger people, students. We also know that a number of people have gone through pre-apprenticeship programs, but they cannot actually get into an apprenticeship program because of other barriers, a lack of transportation, a lack of childcare. So we're looking for proposals to resolve those issues. In addition to putting the RFP out, our discussions with a number of potential providers led us to issue a couple of interagency agreements to provide some short-term immediate services. We've entered into two RFPs with Portland Community College. One of them is to support four summer camps aimed at women to be operated through PCC by the Oregon Tradeswomen Network. And the other program is to support the Evening Trades Pre-Apprenticeship Program in Portland. The Evening Trades Pre-Apprenticeship Program was originally created to support opportunities for women and people of color on the new Columbia Villa project about 8 or 9 years ago. As that project shut down, we realized that we had this great pre-training program, but not a lot of new opportunities to place their graduates. This ODOT Supportive Services Program creates an opportunity to transition a lot of those people. Shortly, I'm going to bring up representatives from those two programs, but the last thing I wanted to say is that we recognize that this is a statewide effort. We have state highways in every part of the state, so we have made a point of reaching out to people in all five ODOT regions. We will have proposals covering all five ODOT regions. The issues that we will need to face in reaching people in Medford, in Eastern Oregon, and Central Oregon as far as transitioning them from training into jobs are different than the ones we see in Portland. So we see we've got a challenge on our hands, but I believe our cooperative relationship with ODOT and a lot of good problem solving will get us there. I would now like to bring up, if I may, Katie Hughes, who is a program coordinator with the Oregon Tradeswomen Incorporated, to talk a little bit about how they've benefited from the interagency agreement that we've entered into with PCC and the program they're operating. And I'd also like to bring up Eddie Lincoln, who is managing the Evening Trades Pre-Apprenticeship Program at PCC, to tell you a little bit about how the supportive service funding that they've received has assisted their program. And I think Katie would also like to have you hear from a couple of her students briefly. Thank you.
Great. And I'll just make sure we don't have any questions for the previous witnesses. It looks like Senator Monroe, did you have a question?
Yes. When we were building the $300 million highway package in 2009, after a year's worth of work, I was on the Ways and Means Committee that was looking at that, and we asked about the percentage of contracts that went to women and minorities. And we got an answer, and it was fairly substantial, and we were very pleased with that until we asked, and what percentage of the total value of contracts is going to women and minorities, and that number was much, much lower. Are you doing anything to rectify that? Are we getting to the place where some of the larger contracts are going to women and minority contractors, not just the little bitty ones that make the number look good?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that's an excellent question. I think that both ODOT and the Bureau believes that one way to increase the number of female and minority workers is to have more female and minority contractors on the job. The issue of contracting and how those contracts are distributed is not an issue that's within the purview of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. That's particularly something that ODOT can address, and I don't know if Mr. Cobb would like to address that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, what Steve had started saying was correct. The answer...
You could just re-identify yourself for our internet audience that I'm sure out there in...
Michael Cobb, Manager, Office of Civil Rights, Oregon Department of Transportation. What Steve had started saying was indeed accurate. In order for us to give more contracts to more contractors, those are business owners that are women and minorities, we need to get more of them into the pipeline, so to speak. We're dealing with a finite number of small firms in Oregon as it is. And then within that finite number, there is even a small and finite number of minority and women-owned firms. But what we are doing is, on the supportive services side of the house, on the small business side, what we're discussing today is workforce development, but on the small business side, we have a host of supportive services programs, mentor, protege programs. I partner with the Turner School of Construction Management as an example, and the whole idea here is to build the existing firms and to grow them to the point that they can be competitive and become attractive to those prime contractors who do the hiring. See, ODOT does not contract directly with those small firms. They're usually in the subcontracting capacity. But through the primes, the idea is to network and build a relationship between the primes and the subs or the DBE, MWESB, ESB firms that we deal with to make them more attractive. So we do have a long-term plan, and we are growing those firms that are available and also looking at developing new firms to bring them in a nutshell.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Sorry for the musical chairs. And now, Katie and Eddie, if you would, whichever one of you wants to go first, and I know you had a couple of people you wanted to bring forward too, Katie, and please start by telling us who you are, and then go ahead and tell us what you have to share.
Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Rosenbaum and Vice Chair Telford. My name is Eddie Lincoln, and members of the committee. My name is Eddie Lincoln. I'm the newly hired ETAP coordinator at Portland Community College, and I have a great opportunity to be here to talk with you today about the ODOT contract and how it has supported the efforts of Evening Trades and Pre-Apprenticeship Program. I'm newly hired there. I've been since November the 15th, but just from a macro view of how dramatic the resources has meant to the Evening Trades and Apprenticeship Program is, when you look at the statewide apprenticeship system, it is a collaboration, it is a co-partnership between the state, between the apprenticeship system, and the community college. And what's unique about that is that it entails classroom instruction and on-the-job training, in which case it becomes very competitive when pre-apprenticeships apply for a full apprenticeship system. So as an evening trades and apprenticeship pre-apprenticeship system, we are mirroring what the state has developed as a statewide apprenticeship and training system. Now what the resources has done is it has allowed us to do greater outreach in the women's and minorities for pre-apprenticeship training. We've also been able to partner with Skills Center to improve the remediation of many of our recruits as they come to the pre-apprenticeship training. It requires some high-level technical skills that really improves their competitive nature when they apply for the apprenticeship systems. We're also able to work with the trades and industries and do incredible outreach to partner with people who are in the industry who have wide range and vast experience about that whole construction trades area, the requirements and the skills necessary to be successful, and how to create a portfolio and to present themselves, represent themselves in, you know, through the application process to represent themselves as skilled pre-apprentices that have the motivation, the inclination, and the determination to be successful as a full apprentice. And it still is a competitive process. It's still a matter of being selected. But what we have truly seen through the dramatic increase and motivation from women and minorities is that the education and outreach has played a large part to the awareness of the apprenticeship systems as a means to be hired in a very living wage jobs areas, jobs that will afford apprentices the opportunity to raise their standard of living, to educate their children, to buy homes, buy cars, and to be self-sufficient. Also, it gives self-pride, tremendous leaderships and skills. One success story that I really just wanted to share with you is that this gentleman here, his name is Ken Riley, was a ETAP graduate who came through the pre-apprenticeship trades, moved to Thornton, Brighton, Colorado, worked as a pre-apprentice there, got into the trades, ran for the regional transportation district in the board of directors there, and was elected as on the regional transportation district in Thornton, Brighton, Colorado. So that's just one of the, you know, success stories that we've had from some of our graduates. If you look at the statistics of the ETAP graduates who complete the pre-apprenticeship and apply for the full apprenticeship systems, we have a high number of those who are successful and are moving into full apprenticeships. Now, as Mr. Sims spoke of earlier, resources to sustain pre-apprenticeships is really needed in order to continue the work that's being done to increase the number of women and minorities applying for the trades. This ODOT grant has been a means to that end, and with other additional resources, we will be able to continue the great work that is taking place. And, of course, I've been in the workforce training business now for the last 20 years with Portland Community. I believe that's one of the reasons why I was hired to do the job. I have considerable networks with with the full apprenticeships, with a vast number of construction companies who are in the business. So they have a high expectation for what ETAP and PCC will do, and I, too, have a pretty high expectation. And so we will continue our outreach and recruitment. We'll continue our assessment and training. We will continue our employment and retention, because what's really what we're seeing is that many of our apprenticeships are single parents. And so when it comes to child care and support services and buying of tools and transportation, it really becomes incumbent upon them to have those basic support services in order to sustain and to be able to go out and do those jobs. I guess that's about as much as I can report on right now, but thank you for this opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much. Katie, go ahead. And I know you have some friends with you, too.
Yeah. So. My name is Katie Hughes. I am the Youth Programming Coordinator with Oregon Tradeswomen. And the money we received from ODOT allowed us to put on our – sorry, let me set this up. Allowed us to have our middle school and high school summer camps, as well as our Building Girls work crew. And I've brought Mary Anna Huntley and Lena Sun, who are part of our work crew, to just tell you just briefly a little bit about their experiences. But on our summer camps, this is a picture from our summer camps, and this is our middle school camp. We were able to bump the number of girls for our middle school camps from 20 up to 34. So we had 34 girls at the middle school camp, and they were helping build a shed for a community garden. Our high school camp, we had 17 girls participate in that, and they built the frame, and then the middle school girls were able to put on the trim and paint and things like that. All the girls got exposure to all the power tools. So this is, she's using a chop saw, and they were able to use a chop saw and a circular saw and lots of hand tools and things like that. The great thing about, I have some statistics about how things went, and we are able to expose girls to math in a really great way. They love it. They get to do it hands-on. They see the point of the Pythagorean theorem. They're not just learning it out of a book, you know. And with the money that we got from ODOT, we were able to double our numbers for camps for from last year. We also doubled the number of young women we served through our work crew. We had we started with 12 last year. I think we graduated 7, and this year we started with 24, and we graduated 18. So it really increased those numbers. And total for the year, we served 2,070 girls so far this year, which is really great. And for the work crew, I just thought the math improvement was really amazing, and so I wanted to show you those numbers. For the Pythagorean theorem, which was we gave them a shed and said, this is how big the shed is, this is the pitch of the roof, tell us how long each piece of wood needs to be. And they got to do it, and they improved 92%. So that's really great. To 100%, all of them got that correct. For fractions, just knowing how to add and subtract fractions and how to properly say them, they improved 43%. And to measure, to take out a tape measure and actually just know how to measure, they improved 225%. And so this is middle school and high school at the end of camp. This is the playhouse that they built for Habitat for Humanity. And there are a ton of girls in that photo. It was a pretty fun day. And this is our work crew. These are two of the girls from our work crew building a bike and garden shed for the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And that's the end of that. Oh, and this is the group shot. We did not coordinate the colors that day, but somehow it worked out. But all of these young women here, this is mostly everyone who graduated, they started out, we were able to provide them with GED training, so they got to, on the clock, study for their GED, practice for their driver's license, arrange childcare, and the idea with our work crew is that they get to, we call it our pre-apprenticeship. So young women who are interested, and we're trying to get the younger girls interested, who aren't quite ready, they don't have their driver's license, they don't have stable housing, they don't really know where their next meal is going to come from, they can do this and kind of get ready, they make some money while they're doing it, and then they can go into our pre-apprenticeship program and actually succeed. So that's kind of the point with this. And so this was all, we were able to do this because of the ODOT funding that we got. And so I'm hoping that Mariana and Lena can both chat too.
Yes, I think Senator Monroe has a question. Go ahead.
Did you teach them to measure twice and cut?
I think I taught them the hard way, but yes. Any other questions?
Great, go ahead. And if you could say your name for the record.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Mariana Huntley. I had the opportunity to work with Katie and the other instructors in the Building Girls Crew program with Oregon Tradeswomen just this past summer, actually. I joined the program not really sure what I was doing, to be honest. I was new to Portland and, quite frankly, needed something to do, some money, wasn't really sure what my game plan was. And, in the end of it, as Katie mentioned, we learned, she taught us, measuring all sorts of math and how to be self-sufficient, in building and how to be working for ourselves and things like that. And in the end of it, I came out with such a strong feeling of I can do it, and construction's great. It was so much fun working with all the girls, and now I know that there's an opportunity there, that I can do construction, that something that I'm interested in, that I can work for, and I was really thankful to have the opportunity to open up the world a little bit to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
My name is Lena Sun, and I did the Oregon Tradeswomen Tech class and Building Girls, and I had a lot of fun doing that. Building Girls taught me how to build and learn how to use hand tools and power tools more correctly. I first heard about OTI while I was incarcerated. I got out, gave them a call, and they gave me an interview. They helped me keep on the right track. Yeah, and Katie Hughes and Amy James did our study, helping me get a career in construction. That's all I got. Thank you.
Well, it's great to see you here and to hear that you're doing so well. And really, this, I have known Connie Ashbrook and the Oregon Tradeswomen and Katie and everybody for a long time, and have to say that this goes to show how one person, really one person with an idea, can start a program that really does manage to do some real good in the community, and it's a pretty amazing thing to look at the number of women through the years, just like you, who have come forward never thinking they would want a job where they worked with tools and worked with their hands and ended up really successful going through apprenticeship and ending up out on the job site. So I'm just really delighted to see you here today and to see how the work is continuing and how we're working with ODOT and the bill that we passed to actually do something good for people. So it's great. Are you actually working on job sites right now, or are you in apprenticeship programs? I wasn't quite clear from what you described where you were at in your careers.
For me, I just finished the Building Girls crew this past summer, and I haven't done the pre-apprenticeship program just yet, but I think there are a few programs this coming. I think there's one in January, maybe in March as well, that I am considering getting into for the pre-apprenticeship.
And do you have an idea, Mariana, about what trade might be most appealing to you? I know something where you use the Pythagorean theorem has to be part of it, but
it's so exciting to actually have a use for that now, right?
Mm-hmm. We're not.
Oh, we're just every day.
Yeah, right.
Every day.
Probably construction. Probably construction. My older sister who lives here is a general contractor, and so I must say I'm a little bit biased. Mm. But it's probably the path I'd take.
Great. And Dina, do you have an idea of what trade you might like to end up in eventually?
Yeah, I like working as a laborer. Yeah, I had a couple of jobs as a laborer and laying out tile for a school.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, any questions? Great. Well, thank you so much for being here and for the whole project, and Eddie especially for your work, and Katie, please send regards back to everybody at Oregon Tradeswomen.
Thank you.
The square of the hypotenuse is equal to the square
of the... I know. I think we've been all silently saying it to ourselves.
I was going to look it up.
Yeah. Just make sure we still remembered it.
It's been a while since.
So did you have any closing remarks, or was that... I don't see any further questions.
If I could just briefly add, I just want to give you some hard figures. The interagency agreement pursuant to Senate Bill 894 against Stephen Sims of Bureau of Labor and Industries was for $1.5 million. 10% of that is to go towards administrative expenses. We have hired one staff member to coordinate this program. So far, we've encumbered $184,000 of those funds. The balance, except for a small retainage of about $100,000, will go out in this RFP that's currently on the street. We anticipate that turning into a hard number of hires by the end of this calendar year. Thank you.
Great, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more as the work goes forward, because obviously we want to see this money get out there and actually see people benefiting by ultimately getting jobs. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for being here. Thank you, ODOT folks. Michael, great. Okay, moving right along, we have another presenter, and that is our good friend Graham Slater, who's here once again and today to present the per capita personal income report that the Employment Department has worked on. I know that the last time Graham was here, we were calling ourselves the Good News Committee, and he was being very, very cheerful about that. But I'm afraid this report is not entirely good news, so we will not hold you to that. I think the good news is going to be what we're going to do about it. So,
okay. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Slater. Administrator of the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division, and it's nice to be back with you my third time this year. So I guess we're sharing some good information, and really that's what we exist for. So I did want to, if I may, just go back to that question about green jobs, now that I can actually talk through a microphone. And the reason we really don't know how many green jobs there would be today is that we've lost so many tens of thousands of jobs across the whole state since 2008. And green jobs itself is not an industry that you can make monthly consistent estimates for. We are planning to do a repeat of our previous green jobs survey next year. So at that point, we'd be able to compare the 50,000 jobs of 2008 and say, so how many are there today? It's quite conceivable you can lose jobs in some industries and still be adding green jobs in their industries. So, you know, you don't just want to apply a percent loss to that. Okay, so moving forward, there's a history to this per capita personal income. And I'll give you definitions and graphs as I usually do. But there's been a problem with per capita personal income in Oregon for really 30 years, and you'll see that in a second. But occasionally it bubbles to the top of everybody's mindset, and this year it really has bubbled, including, I understand, some of you were at the summit yesterday, and it came up several times there. In the summer, Governor Kulongoski asked our director, Lori Warner, to have some of us, and Nick Belaichik, our state employment economist, is here in case we get really detailed, in which case I'll bring him up here. But asked some of our staff to take a look at this, and we took a very quick look in literally 2 weeks, actually met with the governor, kind of shared some quick findings. That turned into this much more in-depth report, and you each have had notification of this. So this report came out about 2 weeks ago, and you know, as the title says, Why Oregon Trails the Nation. I do want to say, if there were simple solutions to this, Oregon would have put them in place in 1985 or 6 or 7 when this first became an issue. So let me step you through the presentation, and I guess, Madam Chair, just get a sense of your timing. How long do you want me to go? Because I know you're maybe a little behind. I'm not sure what your schedule was.
Right. I think probably if you could summarize this in maybe 10 minutes and then open it up for questions,
okay,
that would be great.
Then I can do that, and I will fly through these slides. And I think just seeing me go through those will be helpful. So defining per capita personal income is really key to understand. It's purely a mathematical formula. It's the total income to all the people in the state divided by the number of people. And that mathematical formula becomes really big when you start talking about solving the problem or filling the gap, because you can't get there any easy ways, because the numbers just don't let you do that. I do want to say it's just one of many indicators. It's not the only one. It probably isn't the only thing that anyone should focus on. There's lots going on below the surface. It's an estimate. You don't want to necessarily be putting in major policy changes to fix a number that's a statistical estimate, and particularly in one of the things I'll mention.
Graham, I think Senator Telfer has a question.
Can we go back to that, because it has to do with your calculation. The PCPI, what you're talking about, income. A couple questions. Where do you glean this information from? And if it's coming from tax returns, since I do that for a living, I'm concerned that we're not getting a true picture of like pass-through income, since Oregon, of course, doesn't get that information. They just get a net dollar amount.
And so, Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, one of the points I was going to make just a little later is that we, the Employment Department, don't do any of these numbers. Everything to do with per capita personal income comes from the U.S. federal government, the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And knowing your role, I did bring along some very detailed notes about, particularly on some of the income, you know, where it comes from, IRS Schedule Cs and so on. So I'm not sure I would have the detailed answers to some of those questions, but we'd be happy to chat with you about them. But
okay, yes. That helps me a little bit. Yeah. So it's coming from the feds, who get a little bit of more depth of information on that. Is it tweaked for Oregon then? I mean, how is it tweaked for Oregon?
Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, yes, it's tweaked for Oregon. It's tweaked in different ways for pretty much all of the different components here. And so one of them, for example, proprietor's income, which is not our expertise, but we do know in the report that 52% of the estimate of proprietor's income is what the Bureau of Economic Analysis calls an adjustment for non-reporting. So that's the classic example where they're doing their best with the data that they've got to make really good estimates. But we know from our experience, sometimes you get pretty stretched out from the reality. So it's just good people, bright people making their best estimates. So, okay? Okay. So I do want to make the point that the bottom bullet there, you know, the way that this is being presented this year suggests that our per capita personal income has actually fallen consistently over the years, and I want to make the point that's not true. Our per capita personal income has actually increased over the years. The problem is it hasn't increased as fast as the United States average. So the gap between us and the United States has increased, but we've still been going up, and that'll be evident in a graph here in a second. This one's really important, and in 10 minutes I won't take a lot of time, but the top two bullets basically say this is a mathematical formula. If you're going to improve our standing in per capita income, you either have to increase the income a lot, like 10% across the board, or you've got to get rid of a bunch of people because you've got to shrink the population. And clearly neither of those are particularly easy or viable or maybe desirable things to do. So then the next thing that people will often say is, well, okay, let's bring in some companies with really high-wage jobs. That will solve the problem. And I'm not in any way saying that we shouldn't bring in companies with high-wage jobs, but the example that we put together there, 10 companies, 1,000 jobs each, $100,000 per year per job, so clearly an extreme high-wage company, and that would take us from our current 91.2% to a whopping 91.8%. So my point simply is, it's an incredibly daunting task to think that we can actually, you know, make up the whole difference. And there's a lot of reasons behind it. A lot of these things here are not anyone's fault. They're not the result directly of particular policies. They're the result of thousands, tens of thousands of individuals, and many people in this room probably, like me, came to Oregon from somewhere else. And that is one of the big drivers, is that we continue to have population moving in. And as you'll see in some later slides, there are no states that have rapid per capita personal income growth and rapid population growth. Because, think back to the formula, if your population's growing a lot, your income has to be growing incredibly to make you gain traction against the U.S. average. Okay, looking at the two lines here, the one that ends up at the top, not surprisingly, is the United States average. The one at the bottom is the Oregon average. You can look back over history, and there were times in our history where we were pretty close to the nation, a couple times when we were above the nation. But as you can see, in the early 80s was when we slipped down below, and we essentially have never recovered. We've had a couple good spurts, but we've never really recovered where we were. And this graph, every time the wiggly line goes above that, the straight line, the 100, that means that Oregon is above the nation. And the only time we've been massively above the nation was in World War II, when apparently, long before my time here, there was a lot of shipbuilding with a lot of overtime and a lot of high-wage jobs, and we were way above the nation's average. The only other time really was in the 70s, when construction was doing really well, lumber and wood products was doing phenomenally well, and we had high-wage jobs all across Oregon, not just Willamette Valley, but rural areas all across Oregon. When we pretty much collapsed in the two recessions of the early 80s, that's when we dropped way below the national average. And as you can see, we've never recovered since. We did have a good little boom there with some of the semiconductor and other manufacturing growth in the early 90s, but it kind of disappeared after the Asian financial crisis. And as you can see, as we go down in the last 2 years now, we've ranked worst ever, 32nd in the nation for Oregon, which is our worst in our history. Like a lot of things, and the recent governor's election really has helped me when I give speeches to explain to people why some of the very populated counties drive the statistics. And like a lot of things, a lot of the income in the state, of course, comes from the metropolitan areas, 82%. What we find is that the metro areas on the right there, the metro areas average or per capita income is 38,000 or so, which sounds like a much bigger number than the rural areas at 30,000. Okay, but the metro areas are substantially lower than other metro areas across the United States. So if we take the average for all the metro areas and we compare our metro areas, we're really low. And that's been true. That's the solid line at the bottom. That's been true for a very long time. Now, the rural areas used to be much higher than the rural areas across the United States, comparing rural to rural. And that's because we had that really strong lumber and wood products industry that was paying really high wages for decade after decade. But it changed. You know, the big drop is in the early 80s. We were still somewhat higher, but in the last few years, even that has slid down, so that even the rural areas now are below their national counterparts. The per capita personal income is made up of three main things, and I will just cut through this slide and say the big one is earnings, and that's where we focused a lot of our attention. This graph simply shows at the bottom that's how we fare in terms of earnings, and you can see the solid line. We're consistently below the 100% level. So if we do want to make some efforts to try to at least bridge some of the gap, it's likely going to be in the earnings. It's not going to be in the interest and dividends and rent, because we're doing okay there. We're about at 100% on those. This one's probably more complex than it's worth in the time that I have, but I will simply point to the middle numbers, or the middle column, 91.2%, 94.7%. What this little table is telling us is that in 2009, we were at 91.2% of the nation's average. If we simply adjusted all Oregon's wages for every industry to be at the national average for that industry, we would move from 91.2 to 94.7%. So that alone would bring us up that much in the gap. And then you can see some of the other things, which I'll talk about more in later slides, so I'll move forward. We analyzed a whole bunch of possible factors, because there's an infinite number of things that could cause this. And in fact, a lot of people have studied this and come to the conclusion that there's no one thing causing it. So it's the combination of a lot of things, some big, some small. And three big ones, clearly, are the three on the screen. The short version of this is to say that for a lot of jobs across Oregon, a lot of industries, we simply pay less. And when I gave a presentation on this just a couple of weeks ago, I was explaining about there being high unemployment rates, so there's more people looking for those jobs, and they're probably willing to take lower wages. I was talking about many of us that have come here from other places, and you know, it's very easy to concoct scenarios where an engineer could make $200,000 a year in New York City, but chooses to make $160,000 a year in Portland. Because then they can go to the coast and the mountains and windsurfing and whatever it is they want to do. And you can go back 30 years. Some of you may remember Ed Whitelaw, the University of Oregon professor, his phrase, the second paycheck. And the concept was simply that Oregonians take home a cash paycheck every month, and they take home this non-cash paycheck, which is the mountains and the coast and the hiking and all those things. And if people are willing to come here and work for less, like the engineer, as someone said when I was giving a speech, why would businesses pay lower salaries? Because they can. Why would you pay $200,000 if you've got people willing to work for $160,000? That simply makes sense. On lower wage occupations, we tend to pay higher. So there's an interesting quirk. And that's, of course, because we have a high minimum wage. But whenever you get to the high wage occupations, we almost invariably pay lower. And so that's where some of the big differences in the income come about. Now, this proprietor's income, I mentioned it earlier in response to one of the questions. Again, this one is right on the very edge, or probably past the edge of our expertise, but it does make a big difference when you see numbers like 72%. But I also want to draw your attention to the bottom there. More than half of this is this adjustment that the Bureau of Economic Analysis has to make. So it's an important thing to know about. I'm not sure it's something that we can very easily find solutions to in terms of policy change. We also have a lot of people who live in Oregon, and they earn their money here, but then they work in Oregon, but they live elsewhere. And that also, in the way that the Bureau of Economic Analysis calculates per capita income, that's a problem for us, because all of their earnings, and some of them are high wage earners, particularly in the Portland area, but living in Washington, all of their earnings in the per capita income formula are counted in Washington, not here. However, when Nick and I presented this to the Reset Cabinet, someone very quickly made the point that these people are earning their money in Oregon, they're paying income tax in Oregon, so from a general fund point of view, maybe that's okay. But from a per capita personal income equation point of view, it just kind of makes it look like a problem.
So in other words, they are not counted because they're not Oregon residents.
Correct.
But those wages are Oregon wages and do result in taxes paid on them.
Right, yeah. Madam Chair, yes, correct. So if you just look at the per capita personal income numbers and where we ranked, those people are causing us a problem because they make us look bad. But if you look at are they paying income tax on their wages in Oregon, yes, they are. So they're not causing any real problem from that point of view. So, you know, it's a great example how sometimes a big economic indicator like this can look bad in certain ways, but when you dig a little deeper, you think, okay, well, that's a reason that makes sense. That's not a problem. And I think a lot of the population trends are similar. I mentioned, I think, at the beginning, where, and this is the graph that shows, no state that has high per capita personal income growth, which is the up and down axis, no state also has high population growth. If they did, you'd see little diamonds over in the top right of the graph, but you don't, because it simply doesn't happen that the states in this nation, at least in this long time period we're looking at, have those. And we did a lot of comparing with other states, the highest states, the ones that had grown a lot, and maybe they started similar to us, but they've grown a lot. And there is a lot more detail in the book here. But here's some states that used to be like us, if you will, and they've grown a lot. And the diamonds represent their per capita personal income growth. And you can see it's pretty high. It's a lot higher than ours, which is a little bit buried in our bar. But when you look at their population growth, that's the bars, we're way higher. So none of those states that we might look to and think, well, how can we be more like them? Well, they simply don't have population growth. And that's hard for us to replicate. I'm not sure we even want to. There were some other smaller factors. One was that we have relatively more people still living in the rural areas than a lot of states do. And we also, of course, have a lower cost of living than some of the highest income states. So if you were living in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, you would need a high income just to be able to afford to survive there. Now, we see cost of living in Oregon having gone up over the last decade or so, but nothing like the New Yorks or the Connecticuts. So those states tend to have a higher per capita personal income. Pretty much people have to get that in order to live. And as you can see in the top bullet, if we adjusted for that, which this unrelated study did a couple years ago, that would add about $1,100 a year to our per capita income. Just saying that relative to the cost that we all experience in Oregon, we would be doing a little better. We investigated factors that didn't have a lot of impact, and some of these were surprising. The industry occupation mix, comparing us with the nation, you know, we're not that dissimilar from the nation. There's a few exceptions, but overall it didn't make much difference. Minimum wage I've talked about, we thought maybe federal government employment or spending would make a big difference. Turned out it didn't, except in Washington, D.C., where you have, you know, huge, highly paid federal employees and contractors all kind of clustered in the area. And we thought maybe unionization of the workforce would have an impact. And maybe it does in some places, but not here, because we rank pretty high in terms of unionization in both private and public sectors. But of course, we rank 32nd in per capita personal income. So it doesn't explain anything here. There's some other drivers that are way beyond our expertise, and we listed them there in the report just to say maybe other people want to pick these up. One is quality of life, and it's that second paycheck concept. But then what share of the population have higher education? And you kind of get that chicken and egg thing. Do companies move to Oregon, for example, if we have higher educated people? Or do higher educated people move here if we have companies that need those jobs? And it's kind of a circular thing. But we've issued a report just a couple years ago with Duncan Weiss and Joe Courtright that touched on that. And then tax structure and investment in education, certainly not our expertise, but they might be worth looking into. I'm going to fast forward through this one and just point out that if we start comparing ourselves to other states, we really will be comparing with states where it's almost meaningless. You know, to say that we want to be like Connecticut or New York or New Jersey, we're so different in industry structure and costs and so on. That's probably not a reasonable comparison. One state that did jump into the top five last year was Wyoming. And that's a state that goes up and down, mostly depending on energy costs and energy research. And Wyoming's been as low as 20th in the nation in the last few years, and just last year it was in the top five. So it's very volatile, small state, and it really depends on energy. If we take out the top five, if we just decide there's no way we're going to be like those five, then we actually kind of raise our line, the solid line that's higher up. That's how we look if we compare ourselves only to 45 states instead of all 50. But I do understand you could then say, well, what if we don't compare ourselves to the lowest of the states? Then we can make it look even worse. So, you know, we're not playing with numbers here. We're just pointing out that we are very different to a New York or a Massachusetts for some of those. In summary, just comparing us to those other states, the real takeaway message, again, is that the states that have done better than us, the states that have grown faster than us, typically big reason, number one, had much slower population growth. And again, I don't think there's a lot we can do about that. They did have some concentration and growth in the high-paying industries, and particularly those, you know, in the real high-paying finance sector, thinking New York, Connecticut, insurance, those kind of things, where we have our share of finance and insurance jobs, but we don't have the big headquarters. We don't have, you know, the big investment banks headquartered here, obviously. And in general, most of those states also had lower unemployment rates, so fewer people competing for the jobs, which would drive the wages up, and fewer part-time workers. I did skip over a slide pretty quickly, but you probably read it. We do have more part-time work and a shorter work week than a lot of states. And so none of those, again, are big enough to explain all this, but when you put them all together, you do actually come pretty close to explaining it. So the summary, certainly, bullet number four is there are no simple solutions. And you know, when we started the research, we certainly were looking for some great policy ideas that we could put forward. And I'm sure attracting great businesses with high-wage jobs, of course, that's always going to be on the list. But there are no real single silver bullets here for this problem. We hope that the report will at least help folks like you and the governor and many others really understand kind of what's behind that simple number that you just see, you know, at the summit yesterday or in a news conference. So let me pause there and just ask if you have any questions. I think I'm up to my 10 minutes problem or more.
That really was the lightning round of presentations. Thank you. So I think one of the states that we're always compared to is Washington because it's so close and in some ways similar. So do you have any comments about why things are significantly better in Washington in this measure than they are here?
Madam Chair, Washington ranked 10th last year, and I don't know if Nick would know that we kind of went line by line for Washington comparing. We really focused more on some states that were similar and how they've changed. A couple of obvious things for Washington, as I think I said in unemployment at a previous visit with you, you know, they do have at least a couple of very large employers that are, I mean, huge, far bigger than any single employer that we have. And if those two are doing very well, then you do get some big benefits, including, likely in both of those, some pretty high-wage jobs. Beyond that, we'd be happy to, you know, maybe go line by line and get back to you about Washington. But that would be my initial take. So, okay.
Questions? Yes, Senator Monroe.
I've heard some people say that when unemployment is high in most states, people go someplace else. In Oregon, they stay here. Do you think that's a valid reason why our unemployment rate may be somewhat higher than the national average?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, definitely. And it's a reason for this per capita income issue also. Oregon really only lost, in net, lost people in 2 years in the 80s in that really bad recession. And the whole rest of the time, it doesn't matter that our unemployment, you know, in the last recession, our unemployment rate was second, sometimes first, worst in the nation. People still come here. And that comes back to the second paycheck. Why do they come here? Because, you know, especially in this huge recession, maybe they were laid off in Ohio or Michigan or someplace, and they'd visited someone in the West Coast, and they've always thought about moving here. And so they don't have a job there either. They may as well come take their chances here. I mean, we see that. We hear anecdotes all the time. And again, a lot of the states with the lowest unemployment rates and, in this case, the best growing per capita income, they're states with essentially no population growth or even in some cases declines because people, especially from their rural areas, Nebraska, South Dakota, those kind of states, from their rural areas, people are leaving. And for most of our rural areas, still the population is growing, not as fast as it would have been a few years ago, but it still may be growing, not in all cases. Madam Chair, if I may, just the last two slides of the handout, and I won't talk about them, but we've had a very busy week. We've had news releases yesterday and today, and so I just shared there one slide on the future hiring survey where we asked businesses if they thought they were going to be hiring in the next 6 months. That's the one on the screen right there, and some very interesting findings that we just put out yesterday. You're all looking interested, so I'll just verbalize sufficient. I appreciate your interest. So it's sufficient to say that as we look at employment change over the next 6 months, you know, certainly the majority of firms are saying we don't expect to change employment. And that's pretty consistent with the state revenue and employment forecast that you're all working with right now. You know, yes, some growth, but very slow. We also asked them the reasons, and most of the reasons why they'd be hiring didn't have to do with hiring people back from recession. It was much more to do with turnover, replacing existing workers, or seasonal trends. Also, interestingly, we asked them about occupations, and that's a later discussion maybe. But when we asked them what might be barriers to them hiring in the next 6 months, a relatively small percent blamed government or taxes. And I think maybe that was a surprise, because we know that people always kind of on the lookout for those. But the biggest single factor, two-thirds of the respondents still talked about just the recession and, you know, the worries and the uncertainties and the lack of loans and those kind of things. So it's much broader than just us here in government. And then today we released the unemployment rate and employment release at 10 o'clock this morning. And I will just point you to the third bullet there. We've added almost 18,000 jobs since March, and we added about 13,000 in just the last 2 months. So if you remember in March when I came to you and said we need to be adding 4,000 or 5,000 jobs a month regularly to really see the unemployment rate come down, we've actually done that 2 months in a row now. Now, that's not enough. But after many months of adding just a few hundred and then losing a few hundred, to add 6,000 for both of the last 2 months is certainly encouraging, much better than where we've been. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for ending with good news.
Good news, right?
I did want to ask you one more thing, and you may not want to answer this question, but in light of just the way you describe the per capita income problem, maybe I'll just pose this as a conjecture on my part and see what you think. It seems that this goal of moving us to the average per capita may be a difficult goal to achieve, because so much of what you're describing is basically lifestyle trends. You know, it's hard to imagine, if in fact you're right, that no state that has population growth also has per capita income going in the right direction. I mean, do you think it's a realistic goal, or are there, I mean, I don't think there have been like a lot of proposals put out there for exactly how we're going to do that.
Right, Madam Chair, I mean, I would certainly say it's a very, very difficult goal, and I think I heard in 10 years, and we definitely need, in my opinion, we need to be doing everything we can to be moving incomes up and to be moving towards that. Whether you can mathematically get there in 10 years would be a huge, daunting task. Does that mean it's one you shouldn't try? Absolutely not. But I think it's also good to be realistic to say you don't just pass a couple of bills and a little bit of economic development and get there. I mean, this is huge 30, 40-year situation that we've had. And remember, back in the late 70s, we were a much smaller state, and construction and wood products really dominated a lot of the economy, and they were very high wage. Even if they were growing, and construction had fantastic years, just in the last 6 or 7 years before this downturn, but you didn't see our per capita personal income climbing back up to the national average. So you could have lots of growth in some good industries, but it doesn't look like you would easily get back to 100%. So it's a daunting task. We're certainly all about providing the data to help us make progress. And, you know, lots of policy people are giving it good thought. So.
Great. Well, thank you, as usual.
Thanks very much.
For being such a frequent visitor, too. And finally, we have one more report, and that is on the access to business capital. Tim McCabe was not able to be here today, and we have Paul Grove, I believe, to do the presentation instead. And this is a bill that we passed out of this committee in February, right, to improve use of the small business loan program. And so you're going to tell us a little about how that's working and give us, I believe, a real-life example of somebody who's benefited from it.
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Grove. I'm the Government Relations Manager for Business Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity today to come before you and provide an update on the Access to Business Capital Act, Senate Bill 1017, as you noted, that was passed last February. Also, as you mentioned, Director McCabe is unable to attend. He's at a meeting of the Oregon Innovation Council and sends his regrets. He in particular would like to talk about this bill because of the importance that it's played to helping small businesses provide direct loans in partnership with others. So with me today is John Saris, who is our business finance manager, and Nikos Ridge with Ninkasi Brewing in Eugene to talk about a little bit of the program. So really briefly, before I turn it over to John and to Nikos, as mentioned, this was passed in February and signed by the governor in April. And Senate Bill 1017 did two things, made an important policy change in terms of helping expedite the process to get dollars out the door faster into the hands of business. And secondly, and perhaps most importantly, was it provided a $5 million infusion into the Oregon Business Development Loan Program. At that time, in short, the loan program was in essence taxed, and our ability to make new loans to businesses was severely curtailed. So that infusion of money in February has been very instrumental in the work that we do with small businesses, mid-sized businesses, and John will provide you some more information on that. I'll be very brief. It also made some policy changes as well to our entrepreneurial loan program, which helps startup companies access capital that they might not otherwise be able to get through traditional lending sources. And really quickly, in short, you hear a lot in the news about the work that we do at times with business recruitments, and it garners a lot of headlines. But the vast majority of the work that we do day in and day out is with existing Oregon companies, small businesses, mid-sized businesses, to help them retain jobs, help them grow their business. In May, you heard from Tom Odstad with Oregon Ballistics Labs in Salem and Johnny George with Climax Portable Machine Tools in Noburg, and the companies like Ninkasi's. Day in and day out, that's where we do our work. So with that, I'll yield to John Saris and Nikos, and we can give you some more information on what the program has been doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris, and I'm the Business Services Manager at Business Oregon. I was going to provide a quick update about some of the changes that Senate Bill 1017 provided, both to the Oregon Business Development Fund and the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Program. And then, as Paul mentioned, we'll have Nikos talk to you about the loan that the department was able to provide the company earlier this year. So, as Paul mentioned, one of the key issues that was facing the Oregon Business Development Fund early this year was that it was really fully committed. And without the capitalization that was provided through this bill, we wouldn't be able to continue to extend credit to businesses in need of capital. The Oregon Business Development Fund provides basically term debt financing for capital-based expenditures that businesses have and need to continue to grow their operations. A lot of these businesses, or most of these businesses, are what are called traded sector businesses that manufacture and process goods and services and also distribute goods and services. Since the passage of Senate Bill 1017, the Oregon Business Development Fund has approved and funded 14 different loans, and those loans have extended about $3.9 million in financing, which has helped leverage about $17.6 million to finance these projects. The most important factor is that this has resulted in either the creation or retention of over 461 jobs in Oregon since March 1st. So pretty substantial results. And these projects have occurred in Medford, Cove Junction, Klamath Falls, Kirby, Eugene, Albany, Salem, Portland, Hood River, John Day, Culver, and Redmond. Also, because of the financing, we're able to continue to work with businesses. We currently are working with seven new projects across the state that will help provide over $4.2 million of direct financing to businesses. One important piece that was provided with Senate Bill 1017, it was also provided in conjunction with House Bill 3698, which was the BOOST program, was an additional FTE. This additional staff person has been able to help us package loans, set up loan closings, and also helped prepare loan documents. What that has enabled us to do is to close these loans 50 days faster on Oregon Business Development Funds. So now we're closing those within 30 days instead of 80. And our Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund is closing now within 10 days instead of 45, excuse me. So significant impact to the business community. Once we have these loans approved, we're able to get that money out the door faster. And subsequently, our finance officers are able to underwrite more transactions. So Senate Bill 1017 also did provide a couple of modifications. Those modifications were increases to the approval limits within the agency. So our limits were increased from $100,000 to $250,000, enabling us to approve deals faster, and also extend credit if more than or to lend more than 50% of a project if the applicant had been denied credit by two or more lenders. About 50% of the projects that we're doing right now qualify under one of these two criteria. Real briefly, the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, we'll talk about that. That is our micro-lending program. It extends credit to small and startup businesses. And we work in partnership with small business development centers and other technical service providers to help develop business plans and provide technical assistance to the business to enable success. The Entrepreneurial Development Loan Program is our only program that we can do direct loans to non-traded sector businesses. That's your retail, coffee shops, and retail stores. The provisions and changes to that program, there was a three-year maximum time in business that was removed. The maximum allowable sales was increased from $175,000 to $500,000. And finally, there were modifications to collateral. This program has seen significant demand. Many businesses were using credit cards and short personal lines of credit to start their businesses up. Those are harder to come by, and we've actually seen an increase of up to 400% this year, or this biennia, in activity on this program. Since March, we've funded 9 loans, extending $180,000 in credit, leveraging just short of $700,000, and has resulted in the creation of 15 jobs. These are happening all over the state. We currently are working with 2 new applications. It also should be noted that one thing that the department had the ability to change and did in September was we increased the loan size that EDLF loan applicant could receive from $25,000 to $50,000, further expanding the program and making it useful to business. Really, in summary, we're very appreciative, and the business community is very appreciative of the support that has been extended. These changes, we're continuing to work and tell more businesses about. Later in 2011, we're going to do some more outreach with our partners at the SBA, the Small Business Development Centers, the USDA, and our local economic development districts, hosting lender training and public sessions. So we're going to continue to do outreach. We anticipate program demand is going to continue. These programs have been running at historically high levels, depending on the program, anywhere from 200 to 400% of past levels. We expect that this will continue through 2012 and into 2013. Finally, I know that we're short on time. I'd like to make sure that we have an opportunity for Mr. Dikos to provide us a little update and then answer, obviously, any questions.
Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for having me today. I'm happy to be here in support of the Business Oregon programs that we're talking about today, and appreciate your time and the opportunity to speak. My name is Nikos Ridge. I'm one of the two founders and managing members of Ninkasi Brewing Company. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the history of our company today and some of the ways that the Business Oregon Loan Program has helped us out. Ninkasi Brewing was founded by myself and our brewmaster, Jamie Floyd, about 4.5 years ago. We sold our first keg in the summer of 2006, and thus far have had an overwhelmingly positive response. Originally, it was just the two of us, making beer, washing kegs, getting them filled, selling to accounts, and delivering. It was a lot of work, but we were motivated and excited to be living our dream. After about a year, we were able to purchase our current location in the Whitaker neighborhood of Eugene, and it was the first step towards building the production brewery that we have today. Before I move on to some production numbers, just want to give a quick definition. So I'll be talking about barrels of beer, and a barrel of beer is the standard industry measurement, and it's the equivalent of 2 kegs or 250 pints. So keeping that in mind, we bootstrapped our way through 2007 and 2008, selling 3,000 barrels in 07 and 7,800 barrels the following year, adding equipment and staff along the way when we could afford to and trying to stay ahead of demand. In 2009, we sold 19,000 barrels and were named the fastest growing microbrewery in the United States by the Brewers Association. That year, we advanced into regional brewery status, becoming a brewery selling more than 15,000 barrels annually, the first in Oregon to do so in the last 10 years, following in the footsteps of brewing pioneers like Rogue, Deschutes, Widmer, Full Sail, and others. In late 2009, we began planning for our first major expansion, building more square footage and upgrading to equipment that we could grow into for the next several years. We recently completed our project and are now in a position to meet our growth targets for the future. The expansion was just in time, as in 2010, we'll have maxed out our previous ceiling and we'll have sold more than 30,000 barrels of beer, or more than 7.5 million pints, throughout Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and recently the Bay Area of California. Some of the highlights of our expansion are 10,000 square foot addition with higher ceilings for the installation of much larger processing tanks, a new brewing system capable of producing up to 100,000 barrels annually, more kegs to expand our footprint, more equipment to help create a safer and more efficient work environment like keg lifting assist devices and process piping, and a new much faster bottling line that will allow us to finally enter into the 12-ounce bottle market, which we haven't been able to do and which makes up the majority of craft beer sales in the industry. So that's something we're excited about for next year. So financing the project. While we were ultimately successful securing the financing for our project, it was an arduous and very involved process consisting of multiple partners and a lot of legwork. We worked through the difficulties of an original banking partner that ultimately went out of business and lost a lot of time in moving forward through other avenues. However, due in a large part to working with OBDF, we were able to put together a financial package that made the project an ultimate success. The funding we received and the ability of the OBDF to partner in a supportive way with our private lenders allowed us to access and leverage capital that would likely have been unavailable or much more difficult to obtain under other circumstances. State of the banking industry having been weakened by the economy was understandably create a lot of risk aversion. And by coming in as a lending partner in support of our project, the OBDF helped to mitigate the risk, leverage private funds, and move the project forward. So ultimately, the $502,000 provided by the OBDF leveraged over $4 million, a significant amount of which went to contractors and local builders that worked on the project to its completion, and they'll also continue to support ongoing maintenance and upgrades to our facility. As a result of this expansion, we're poised to take advantage of the growth opportunities that Ninkasi has in front of it in an industry that has been able to successfully weather and, in fact, grow through this recession. We expect to have over 50 employees by the beginning of the first quarter of 2011 and grow to 50,000 barrels by year end. All of our employees earn above average manufacturing wages and have benefits package that includes fully paid health care coverage. We're pretty proud of that as a company that has been in business for less than 5 years. As a native of Oregon, born in Eugene, I'm excited to have a business based in the state that exports its products out of state, brings dollars back into our communities, puts Eugene on the map for craft beer, and brings visitors into our town and neighborhood to visit the brewery and see what we do. The business development funds that we've been able to access through the OBDF programs and Business Oregon have been a necessary component of our growth and have allowed us to continue to grow, to create jobs, and to be a bright spot in a difficult business environment. So just a brief recap, we've created 50 jobs in under 5 years. We're an exporting manufacturing business that creates skilled family wage jobs and offers full health benefits. Our products bring people into our state and into our community for brewery tours, tastings, and events. We're poised with our recently completed expansion to produce 100,000 barrels of beer annually from our current production level of 30,000 barrels and create more jobs and tax revenues as we grow. And our expansion was brought to its successful conclusion through the access to capital provided by Business Oregon and the OBDF. We care about our people, we care about our community, and we care about our state. We feel that by supporting small businesses and helping them to grow, the funds available through Business Oregon help to foster recovery on the economic front, and in our case have created sustainable, clean, long-term, living wage manufacturing jobs in Oregon. Thanks for your support, and thank you to Business Oregon for helping us to achieve our goals.
Thank you for your presentation. I have to say Senator Floyd Przanski is a member of this committee, but not here today. He's going to be really, really sorry that he missed this, since he is a huge fan of your story and your product.
I bet you I'll run into him at the brewery.
I have a feeling you probably will see him soon. But it's a great story, and certainly I think your success has been touted and publicized a lot, and it really is a shining example in what's been a pretty bleak time. I wanted to just ask you how, because it sounds like from your description of the business plan, you wouldn't have qualified for this loan program under its old criteria of having existed for 3 years or less, unless I'm confusing two different sets of, yeah, I am.
We may have been right on the cusp, but just over 3 years.
And then how did you become aware of the program in order to take advantage of it? Because one of the things we talk a lot about, although this one I think is being utilized pretty fully at the moment, is sometimes we aren't doing as good a job of marketing these programs as we could be to smaller businesses that need to take advantage of them.
I was introduced to it through LCOG, so the Lane Council of Governments, who help support Lane area businesses with the SBA and with other programs that are available. So they made an introduction.
And if I may, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. You're hearing a lot of talk, about the alignment of resources and how we can best be communicating. And really, at Business Oregon, we're dependent upon our partners out in the field, the LCOG or the Regional Economic Development Organizations throughout the state. We only have 9 business development officers that serve the state to work with companies like Ninkasi and others. And so really it's the partnerships that we form with groups like LCOG and others that allow us to facilitate the connection and then help put the package together to finance these types of companies. The OBDF loan program is really a gap financing tool where we come in and partner with traditional lenders, economic development organizations, and others. But the long and the short of it is we have very limited staff, or very small staff, and so we're dependent upon LCOG and others to help spread the word about the resources that are out there and availability of these types of programs.
Great. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Great
Thank
presentation.
You.
So, members, that concludes our agenda for today, and I have to say this is the last meeting of this committee, so don't get all weepy on me, but I do want I do want to thank Vice Chair Telfer and Senator Monroe, who was a late arrival to the committee, as well as the members that are absent. It's been a great experience chairing this committee for me. I think we really, as you can see, have put out some good products through the time that we've been together, and Teresa Van Winkle and our committee assistant, Cindy, how could I forget, have been really troopers. So just thank you for all of your work and for your attention.
It's been a pleasure. Let's hopefully somebody's picking up the ball here and helping develop our workforce out there. So,
right. I think the issues that we have been working on have been realigned a little bit in the new committee structure, but I'm pretty confident that we will be working on them in those new committees. So, well, thank you.
So we're adjourned to go have a beer?
To come for the fresh. That's a great idea. We are adjourned.